to see your interest in spiritual things. If you would please open your Bibles to Acts chapter 27. Acts chapter 27. As you see on the board, we're going to be talking about these two chapters, Acts chapter 27 and 28. Now, that's not all we're going to talk about, but that's going to be the basis of our study, these two chapters. We noted in our previous studies that the Apostle Paul is assured that he's going to see Rome. We know then that when he arrives in Jerusalem, anticipating the things that have been told him by Agabus and by the Spirit, I believe three times the things that he was to suffer when he arrived in Jerusalem. Paul said that he was going, and if that meant that he was to die, then so be it. That's in Acts chapter 21 where he is arrested. Now, we've noted the various chapters, and James, I'm going to pick on you again. Acts chapter 21, we have him arrested. In Acts 22, what do we have?
Well, he's before Jewish people.
All right, and 23?
Then he goes before the Sanhedrin.
Yes, 24?
Then he goes before Felix, then before Festus, then before Agrippa.
All right, good. That gets 24, 25, and 26. Now, in chapter 27, we read about this journey to Rome. Now, where is Paul when this journey to Rome begins? He's in Caesarea. Why is he in Caesarea?
He's been in prison down there for each person to hear his case.
All right. All right, he's been there at least 2 years, and then to add to that the time that he was in Jerusalem. Why was he moved from Jerusalem to Caesarea, Carolyn?
There was a murder plot against him.
There was, yes. What was the captain's name that preserved or saved Paul from the plot in Jerusalem? Johnny? Claudius Lysias, yes, Claudius Lysias. And we see him rescuing Paul at least three times. One from the angry mob that resulted then in Paul's speech in Acts 22, and then from the angry, divided Jewish Sanhedrin council in Acts chapter 23. And of course, in there, I forget the chapter, where he moved him from Jerusalem then to do the latter part of chapter 23, I would say, from Jerusalem to Caesarea, because Paul learned through his nephew of the plot to kill him. Now, this journey in chapter 27, beginning in verse 1, "And when it was determined that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners to a centurion named Julius of the Augustan band." Now, there's so many intriguing things. We're not going to have the time, as Richard accuses me of doing a verse-by-verse study of this, although that's very tempting. And he heard his name. So we're going to be looking at this somewhat generally and talking a little bit more about Paul's teaching and preaching and so forth. But we notice in this text it says that they he and certain other prisoners were delivered. Notice the pronoun in verse 1. "When it was determined that we should set sail for Italy." Who's with Paul? That becomes important because we know that Paul was with, or that Luke was with Paul much later on, and even in parts of the imprisonment, he was there. We see evidence of that in other texts. In verse 2, it says, "And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail unto the places on the coast of Asia, we put to sea." Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. And the next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go unto his friends and refresh himself. "And putting to sea from thence, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary." I want to pause here and let's look just briefly at our map. Now, this map shows the travel of Paul all the way to Rome. We're going to look at this in bits and pieces as we go along. But we know that this journey began about, or the fall of about A.D. 60. Paul and certain other prisoners, as we know, he entered into the ship. We know that counting the people on board, you can do the math, and we know that there were 276 people on board this ship. Now, I don't know a whole lot about sailing, so some of you may have to help me with some of this material, except what I have read. Any of you ever do any actual sailing? Well, you know about as much about as I do. Well, except perhaps from what you've read. But I think that'll be helpful to us. We've got 276 people on board this ship, plus we have it evidently being a transport ship for grain. We see evidence of that later on, which tells us that the size of the ship is a pretty good size ship. We've already noted that Aristarchus and Luke were with Paul, and he's sailing from Caesarea to Sidon. Now, from Caesarea to Sidon, not all that far. Seems like I remember in the neighborhood of 100 miles or less, thereabouts. But we know that he sailed on the protected side through here between what we see here as Asia, Galatia, Cilicia, where Paul was from, and the island then of Cyprus. Now, you recall in our previous studies, as Paul began his preaching journeys in Antioch of Syria, he sailed to the island of Cyprus. Now, we can read about that in Acts chapter 13. Yes?
I'm just saying, in his first journey.
What did I say? Yeah, well, you're right. I don't know what I said.
You said journeys. The second one,
yes, he went up this way, the second one. Yes. But yeah, but the first one, he came to, what's the name of the Salamis, and what's over here? Paphos? Is that it? Paphos? Okay. Okay. So this island was familiar to Paul. But they sail up on this side of it, and I want you to notice the reason that is given. My Bible has changed pages. Let's see. Back in verse 2, they sailed along the coast. Lost my place. Verse 4 it is. And putting to sea from thence, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. Now, somebody explain to me, what does it mean by this expression, lee? What is the lee side of a piece of land or an island of
sort? The New American Standard says under the shelter.
The sheltered side, yes. What does that tell us when Paul says the winds were contrary to us? Which direction were the winds going, David?
But at this time, they didn't have a land being sailed, so they could only go with the wind.
All right.
Later on, in sailing history,
alright, so Paul goes on this side of the island of Cyprus in this ship to be protected from the winds, which tells us, I think, that the winds were probably coming like so as he went on that side, and it's referred to as the sheltered side. In verse 5, it says, "And when we had sailed across the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, city of Lycia." Now, here we've got him continuing to Myra, and we're going to talk about this in just a little bit. But this is where we've got him so far, in Lycia. And as you read on further in this text, in verse 6, "And the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us thereon." Now, again, I'm not very well acquainted with sailing or especially traveling back in ancient times. But when it indicates that the captain found a ship sailing, or the centurion, rather, found a ship of Alexandria. Where's this ship from? Where's Alexandria? All right, it's down here somewhere in Egypt. Now this ship sailing for Asia. So this is the destination. But he's up here. And so when the captain located this ship that was going that way, that's going to be a transport for a portion of the journey. Yes.
Because the ship was sailing for Italy. Huh?
For Italy, okay. Yeah.
Which
they're
mean,
in.
Yeah.
This
area.
Okay. Yeah, heading up here.
Most likely the boat or ship that they were using to travel on the coast was more of a coastal ship than an open ocean ship. And so when they got to Myra or wherever it was they changed ships, the guy that was going to Italy was probably in a ship that was suited for traveling in the open ocean.
Certainly, because he's down here. He's from Alexandria. He came across the ocean, obviously. So yes, very good. In the latter portion of this, in verse 7, it says, "And when he had sailed slowly many days, and were come with difficulty over against Cnidus, the wind, not further suffering us, we sailed under the lee of Crete over against Salmone, and with difficulty coasting along it, we came unto a certain place called Fair Havens, nigh unto the city of Lacia." Now, question. When the apostle is describing sailing, again, contrary to the winds, David, elaborate with me just a little bit. The winds not suffering, the winds not cooperating. Which directions are the direction are the winds coming from?
Right into the bow, so it's coming right in. Yeah.
Just like that. Okay.
They usually do that over the barge.
Yes. Yes. Which is why Paul is critical of their sailing this time of the year when they get to this place called Fair Haven. Verse 9. It says, "When much time was spent, and the voyage was now dangerous, because the fast was now already gone by, Paul admonished them and said unto them, Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the lading and the ship, but also of our lives." Now, as we see on this chart, they're trying to reach here. Of course, they're on their way here, and there is great difficulty because of the wind. Good sailing season, as David has pointed out, has already passed. Now, we know that they make it to Fair Havens. This text indicates something I think that we need to pause and note. The time of the fast. When is that? Well, as we have on the board, late September, early October. So we're looking at the winter months. I wouldn't want to be out on the Mediterranean Sea in the winter months. I wouldn't want to be on any sea in the winter months. But especially here, I understand that the winds are very, very tempestuous. But the centurion, verse 11, gave more heed to the master and to the owner of the ship than to those things which were spoken by Paul. You find that fascinating? Maybe even a little bit amusing. The centurion, what's his job?
Guard the prisoners.
Guard the prisoners. That's right. Is it his job to direct the ship? Well, no, he's not going to listen to Paul. Who in the world is Paul?
Prisoner.
He's a prisoner. We're not going to listen to Paul. And who is it that has much to gain or lose in this? Yeah, the owner of the ship. So we're going to listen to the owner of the ship instead of listening to Paul. In verse 12 it says, "And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, the more part advised to put to sea from thence, if by any means they could reach Phoenix and winter there, which is a haven of Crete, looking northeast and southeast." Well, let's pause right there for just a moment. They're trying to make it from Fair Havens over to Phoenix. Now, Phoenix is in this little area. Now, why? What's better about Phoenix? We don't see it so well on this map, but a close-up map helps us some.
My verse 12 says, "A harbor of Crete facing southwest and northwest."
All right, what makes that better?
Well, you said something completely different.
Oh, look at verse 12 again.
Southeast.
Looking northeast and southeast.
That's completely different.
And I've got a footnote says down the southwest wind and down the northwest wind. Okay, does that fit?
Facing southwest and northwest.
Doesn't talk about
it. All right. Well, when we look at northeast, evidently there's a little cove in here where this place was from maps that are larger than this. I should have provided one. I'm sorry. But I think that it's back up in a little hole facing this way and this way, which if you look at the winds and the direction that the winds took them, what does that tell us about the direction of the wind? Now this, you may see it on some maps just doing this. This simply means that the winds were unfavorable. They didn't know where they were. But what direction do the winds come out of during this time of year? David? Coming out of the west, just like we've talked about here. Now what did the winds do to them? When they got out just a little bit on their way to this better place to winter, Phoenix, what caught them? The wind did. Now, they thought it would be good. They're on the leeward side of the island, and you've got a little bit of calm water, but evidently the winds picked up when they put out, and here's what happened. In verse 13, and when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close inshore. Now, that'd be fine if you can just stay right up here near the banks and make Phoenix. But what happened again? The winds caught them. And what did it do? In verse 14, it says, but after no long time, there beat down from it a tempestuous wind called Eroculo. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, they gave way to it and were driven. Now, what's the wind doing to them? They just surrendered. You can't sail contrary, as David has pointed out. You can't sail contrary to the wind. And so the wind is just taking them out into the sea. In verse 16. It says, in running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were able with difficulty to secure the boat. And when they had hoisted it up, they used helps undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should be cast upon the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and so were driven. Now, again, I don't understand a whole lot about sailing. I've never done that at all. But from what I've read, when they undergird the ship, what they did is take cables. And from what I have been informed from, they'd take those cables and would lay them under the ship and then tie them up good and tight. Now, the purpose of that, you can obviously see, it'd be keep the ship together. Now, in doing so, when you put these cables along the bottom side of the ship, what's that going to do? It'll create drag, will it not? So you wouldn't just keep them there, but they're there now during this storm to hold the ship together. And you might raise some questions about, well, how were they installed? I don't know. But what I do know is they're out here in the water and the sea is billowing and they're not crawling underneath the ship, do they?
The New American Standard says they hoisted it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground in the shallows of Syrtis, they let down the sea anchor.
All right, that's what they did.
Anchor slowed them down.
That's right. Taking down the sails would slow them down. The drag of the cables would slow them down. Also hold the ship together. Richard and then Carolyn, please.
The purpose of the anchor, the sea anchor, is to put in drag. This is not an iron anchor.
No, they
found. It's a cone, and they put it in there, and it just drags through the water.
Would be a good thing if it was something that would anchor them to the bottom, I suppose, in some respects.
Would leave there for that.
Well, usually if you do that, you lose your anchor. They put their sails down, but usually you don't put your anchor down. And that's usually the landing anchor is a last resort. If you're fixing to get blown up on the rocks, then they put it down. But this is one just to keep them from not going too far off the course.
which we see in the 28th chapter. They put these type anchors down. Randy, Carolyn, then Randy.
We had a boat, but not a sailboat. But when you dry dock a boat, you put canvas or whatever there, supports underneath. I watched that a few times as a kid. But because you're saying how to get them around, well, you start two people at one end, I believe, and they just
walk them back.
Let rope out, rope stuff, right? And you know, would walk towards the center of the ship, and then end up underneath.
Walking them back. I read something to that effect, that they drop them down over the front. Now, the front of the boat is called
the bow.
Then put them down over the front of the boat, and don't call it a boat, it's a ship, and walk them back and tie them in place to secure the ship. All right? So here they are, sailing on past Crete, the shipwreck here, and this is what we want to spend just a little bit of time talking about. Sir?
You know where Cirrus is? Because they were fearing that they might run around the shallows of Cirrus. That's why
I have, but I don't have that in my notes, and I hadn't planned on talking about it, so I'm not sure. I've forgotten.
My understanding is it's a shallow bank off of Libya.
Okay.
Though, as I look at it here, it doesn't look particularly shallow. I've got one here that indicates that it's 1,600 feet deep. But still.
Ooh.
But there apparently are shallows in that area.
Is it an island? Seriously?
No.
I don't think so.
It's just the bank underneath the water.
Kind of like a sandbar.
Yeah. At this time, it was the Bermuda Triangle in the Mediterranean Sea. It was called the Ship Graveyard.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ships that sank there.
Interesting. Anyway, back to the anchor, you know, the sea anchor. According to Google Earth, the depth of the ocean in this area is over a mile deep.
Yeah.
So they're not letting down an iron anchor trying to drag on anything. So you've got nothing to hold on to.
No. Okay. So that's very helpful. But as we look, beginning in verse 20, where did I get to? Verse 18. It says, "And as we labored exceedingly with the storm, the next day they began to throw the freight overboard. And the third day, they cast out with their own hands the tackling of the ship." What are they throwing away? Not only the cargo that they are transporting, but now what are they throwing away?
Some of the gear.
Some of the gear that's necessary to run the ship. What are they trying to do with the ship?
Lightning.
That's right. Get it up out of the water as much as they can. In verse 20, it says, "And when neither sun nor stars shone upon us for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was now taken away. And when they had been long without food, then Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me, and not have set sail from Crete, and have gotten this injury and loss. Far be it from me to say I told you so, but you should have stayed on the Isle of Crete. It says, And now I exhort you, be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of God, whose I am, whom also I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul, thou must stand before Caesar, and lo, God hath granted thee all them that sail with thee." Let's pause right there. We'll pick up at verse 25. But as we pause right there, we note that Paul has been told, again, you're going to stand before Caesar, and you're not going to perish. Those who are traveling with you are not going to perish. He said, "Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God, that it shall be even so as hath been spoken unto me. But we must cast upon a certain island." This statement has been very impressive to me over the years. "But I believe God." Circumstances are grim. Things look just awful. Anyone in his right mind facing a tempestuous sea such as this would think that it's just all over. We're going to perish. But Paul says, "No, we're not going to perish. I'm going to Rome." Why? Because that's what God said. And I believe what God said. Now, what about you? I'm confident that there's a lesson to be learned here. Some things are pretty grim. And sometimes we forget about what God said. And we suffer the consequences because we simply don't believe what God said. Now, it's not my purpose this evening to elaborate and preach a sermon on that, but it would make a sermon. of things that God has promised. For example, I had someone tell me one time that they were enduring some real difficult times, and they said, God can't help me, or God didn't help me. I could cite a number of examples such as that. Often people blame God for bad things that happen to them. But when we look at what God has said to the persecuted Hebrews, some of them losing their homes, losing their lives, being in prison, losing their jobs, various sundry things. To those Hebrews who would be faithful to God, God said, I will never leave you, and I will never in any wise forsake you. Now, do you believe that? Now, that might be real easy to believe when things are going good. I've used this illustration a time or two, you may recall it, of a lady that lost a child. And while she was with child, she was faithful. Before then, she was faithful. But when she lost her child, he didn't live very long. She became unfaithful. And the gentleman that talked with her, he wanted to know why. What's happened in your life to cause you to do this? She said, well, I lost my baby. God didn't do anything about it. She said, I prayed and I prayed and I prayed and my baby died, and so I just can't talk to God anymore. He said, what a pity, when you needed him the most. She'd stopped talking with God. Well, had she forgotten what God had promised? You be faithful to me and I won't ever leave you. I won't in any wise forsake you. Now question, does that mean everything's going to be fine in our lives? Well, no. No, it doesn't mean we're going to have a life free from trouble. Paul was in trouble here, but he said, I believe what God said.
Well, exactly. I mean, God told Paul, as he used the word, how it's going to turn out. God told Paul how it's going to end. He kind of left out the part about the shipwreck and everything
else.
Yeah. You know, yeah. The fact is, you're right. I mean, life, we have a lot of storms, we have a lot of trials, but we know how it's going to turn out in the end.
If we'll listen.
If we're faithful.
That's right. And I think that's a point we need to be reminded of from time to time. David?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, the angel comes to Paul, and Paul's already told he's going to go to Caesar, you know, before Caesar. But this time, not only Paul, he tells, you know, gives him word that the crew, the passengers, are going to be saved too, which is, you know, a little bit more than the last time, you know, but because of the circumstances that came up. I mean, this was a promise to Paul, but also to them.
Well, that's right. And of course, prior to this, if you back up there to verse 10, Paul had admonished them, sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the lading of the ship, but also of our lives. Now, according to ordinary circumstances, that's what would take place.
Right. When he told them not to go, that wasn't a vision they got or an angel vision. That was just, he's got 3,500 miles in sailing.
Oh, yeah, he sailed all over the Mediterranean.
Yeah, he's already been shipwrecked.
Well, a whole lot of it.
And stuff, so, you know, he's experienced with that. And that was, I think, from his experience, he told them not to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
He's
been on two shipwrecks already, or three?
Yeah,
two or three. Look at 2 Corinthians 11.
Three times?
11:25. Yeah, three times.
Three times of a shipwreck. So yeah. Is this one of those?
No, this is one in addition to those.
Yeah, this is exactly.
This is number four at least. Keep in mind that at the time that he wrote 2 Corinthians, that was prior to his arrival and arrest and so forth in Jerusalem. He was writing 2 Corinthians from Macedonia, and at that time he had already suffered shipwreck three times.
Well,
he
was talking from experience.
Yes, sir.
That's why he says there's
nine. Yeah, this don't work sailing this time of year. Not a good idea. That's right.
Spend a night and a day in the deep.
Yeah.
Float.
Yeah. 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 But he knows at this point that none of them will die. And we're going to see that put to the test in just a little bit. But we also want to note verse 26, but we must be cast upon a certain island. Paul knows that they're going to be preserved. Now here we are. After the fast, we're in the early part, if you please, of the winter. And we know that ships often would winter in a harbor that was, as we use the word, commodious. In other words, it had the necessities that you would need to spend a lot of time in that area, perhaps to restock the ship for sailing in the spring and the needs that you have just now and so forth. And so Paul says we're going to be shipwrecked, but we're going to go on a certain island. Now, we later learn that that provided them with the things, the sustenance, and so forth they need. It says, but when the 14th night was come, as we were driven to and fro in the sea of Adria, about midnight, the sailors surmised that they were drawing near to some country, and they sounded and found 20 fathoms. And after a little space, they sounded again and found 15 fathoms. Now, we've all done this, either on a greater scale or a minor scale. When I was growing up, we had a cistern on the farm. And depending on the depth of the water in the cistern, it determined when it would rain, whether or not Dad would turn the gutters to go into the cistern. Sound familiar to you, Dave? But we had a big long stick that had marks along the stick measuring. And you stick that stick down into the cistern and measure the depth of the water. Now, what they're doing when they sound it was essentially that, measuring the depth of the water. They might be using a rope or a cable or something to determine just how deep the water was. But what was the water doing? Getting shallower and shallower. And what does that mean? We're going to hit land. Yeah, this is not good. And, of course, in the tempestuous sea, the rocks around the land would just really destroy things. In verse 29, it says, in fearing lest haply we should be cast ashore on rocky ground, they let go four anchors from the stern. Carolyn, what part of the ship is that? That's the back part, it said. And wished for day. Four anchors. What kind of anchors were these, Richard?
It's still sea anchors.
Okay. Still sea anchors. I thought it would be the...
No, they're still way too deep.
Other kind. Okay. I just was curious. In verse 30 it says, and the sailors were seeking to flee out of the ship and had lowered the boat into the sea under color as though they would lay out anchors from the foreship. That would be the front part. Now again, what kind of anchors would they put up there? Same kind? Just to slow the thing down and create drag.
They want to keep it there where they are.
Okay. They don't want to hit the rocks or hit the coast.
That's a bad thing.
Pardon me?
That's a bad thing.
That would be a bad thing. Yeah. Yeah. And in verse 31, Paul said to the centurion and to the sailors, except these abide in the ship, ye cannot be saved. Not only would those who get in the little lifeboats be lost, but everybody's going to be lost, it would appear. You cannot be saved except they stay in the boat. And so what did the soldiers do?
Cut
the ropes and let the boat fall. In verse 33, and while the day was coming on, Paul besought them to take... are all to take some food, saying, this day is the 14th day that ye wait and continue fasting, having taken nothing. Wherefore I beseech you to take some food, for this is for your safety, for there shall not a hair perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said this, and had taken bread, he gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he brake it and began to eat. Then were they all of good cheer, and themselves also took food, and we were all in all the ship 260 souls. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. And when it was day, they knew not the land, but they perceived a certain bay with a beach, and they took counsel whether they could drive the ship upon it. And casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea. Now what have they done?
All right.
It says that they loosed the bands of the rudders and hoisting up the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. What are they hoping that the foresail will do? Drag them into this sandy area that they aim to beach the ship on. In verse 41 it says, but lighting upon a place where two seas meet, they ran the vessel aground, and the foreship struck, and remained unmovable. But the stern began to break up by the violence of the waves. That's draws a picture, I think, for us. You've got the front end stuck in the sand, and you've got the waves just beating the back end until it's just torn or tears the ship apart. In verse 40,
they try not to get it sideways. That's what happens. Front stuck, back got around, and once it gets sideways,
breaks the ship. Yeah. In verse 42, it says, and the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners. Why? So they would escape. Now, we've experienced that before in the book of Acts, haven't we? When we talked about the Philippian jailer and how that the Philippian jailer, supposing that the prisoners had escaped, drew his sword and was about to kill himself. Why? So what if the prisoners escape? All right, you're dead. You have to pay for that. And so that's what these soldiers are proposing, lest any of them should swim out and escape. Verse 43, but the centurion, desiring to save Paul, stayed them from their purpose and commanded that they who could swim should cast themselves overboard and get first to the land, and the rest, some on planks and some on other things from the ship. And so it came to pass that they all escaped safe to the land. Now, notice again, all in accordance with what the apostle has told them. You know, you can't use these life boats. Stay on the ship, eat. You're going to need your strength because you're going to have to save yourselves in just a little while. Now, we say save yourselves. There's a lesson in that. There was something they were instructed to do. They were told those who could swim, get in the water and swim. Those of you that can't, get on the boards and the things at the ship and work yourself to the shore. Now, chapter 28. And when they were escaped, then we knew that the island was called Melita. Some of you may be reading from a translation that calls it Malta. But it's this little tiny island over here that we have this arrow pointing to. In verse 2, it says, and the barbarians showed us no common kindness, for they kindled the fire and received us all because of the present rain and because of the cold. How do the citizens, as it were, of Melita receive these folks who are in trouble? With kindness, yes.
Yours reads funny.
It does. I know that.
This one says extraordinary kindness.
Yeah. No common. In other words, it was not common. It was way up there, extraordinary. So they went overboard, no pun intended, to express kindness to these who are suffering the shipwreck. In verse 3, it says, but when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out by reason of the heat and fastened on his hand. Now, without necessarily reading all of this, what is the perception of those on the island? David?
I've read stories about when the shipwrecks, like in Salem, as we read the book and just talk about the shipwreck, everybody drops what they're doing, they all go down and help, try to save the people, and then they do everything they can to make sure they got food and all that stuff. So that's kind of the attitude of people that depend on sailing themselves and stuff. Very kind to the people that are in that predicament. I was just reading Malta. I think it was Melita at the time of Paul, but later on it was changed to Malta. And Malta means refuge.
No, I didn't know that.
I guess it renamed it after that.
That's interesting. James?
These natives are thinking karma. What goes around comes around. This guy got bit and he's done something.
Yeah. Well, yes, of course, you've got people that are idolatrous, obviously, on this island, which indicates that if he's been bitten by a poisonous snake, he should die. He escaped the sea, and so he's guilty of something, or this snake would not have bitten him. So the gods are going to punish him. He's going to die. But yet we find that he did not die. He shook the viper off into the fire, and by the time he ought to be getting sick or dead, there's no effect upon him. And now what do these, they're called barbarians, what do these people who are idolatrous, what do they think about Paul now? Oh, he's a god now. Yeah, he must be a god. Now in verse 7, I'm sorry.
I just want to mention, because you've already mentioned it, this shows Paul's faith in him, because Paul's a man. He could have said, wow, I just got shipwrecked, now I get, and stuff that he believed he was going to be for Caesar.
So yes.
This shows his faith also. He didn't scream out, well, why me? Why did, went through all this, but I'm getting good by faith. So again, he's a man, so he does have fears and doubts, just like any of us.
Sure. But he knows he's going to Rome.
Yeah, so this was showing his faith.
Yes. Very good. I had not connected that in this verse, but that's right. Randy?
I don't know when Mark wrote his book, but right toward the end, he says in verse 17 of 16, these signs will accompany those who believe. In my name they will cast out demons, they will speak with new tongues, they will pick up serpents, and if they drink any deadly poison, they will not hurt them, they will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover. So then when the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was received up in heaven and sat down at the right hand of God. And went about and preached everywhere while the Lord worked with them and confirmed the word by the signs that followed. But he mentions about picking up serpents there. And I don't know, Mark was a traveling companion of Paul's for a while. If this was written afterwards or...
I don't know. I don't know when Mark wrote. There are those, of course, who question the latter part of Mark as to whether or not it is authentic. I believe that it is. But it doesn't change anything if it isn't, because what we find here is Paul doing the very thing that tells us, not only being bitten by this serpent and it having no effect upon him, but we know while he was upon this island, he performed these miracles and healed folks and so forth, just as Mark has said. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Richard?
It's interesting to note that the people that feel that they can do this today spend a lot of time, giving themselves small doses of this toxin so that they can live through it. Yet I don't believe Paul did any of that. I mean, he picked up a serpent that bit him, and they expected him to die, and he didn't.
You mean he didn't start with just a little bit, and then a little bit more, and a little bit more?
It certainly seemed to be the case.
Yes. Well, the probability here, too, is that this was something that was unexpected. He didn't cast himself in a pit of snakes just to see what would happen.
Yeah.
All right. In verse 7, it says, and in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island named Publius, who received us and entertained us 3 days courteously. It was so that the father of Publius lay sick of fever and dysentery, unto whom Paul entered in and prayed, and laying his hands on him, healed him. And when this was done, the rest also that were that had diseases in the island came and were cured, who also honored us with many honors. And when we sailed, they put on board such things as we needed. So the people of the island, they provide for Paul. Paul has provided for them. He has proven who he is. Whatever authority that he has as an apostle has been established by the miracles. Now, can you picture in your mind the Apostle Paul being on this island, being bitten by a snake, healing folks who are about to die, every one of them getting well, survived miraculously, and him saying nothing at all about him who gave Paul this power? What's a given that Paul did during the time he was on this island?
Well, much like when the other folks were wanting, when he was in the city or wherever, that they wanted to sacrifice to him. And he said they just were barely able to keep them from sacrificing to them. And then he spoke to them plainly as to their relationship with the one God as opposed to the ones that they had been thinking that they were.
Right, right, right. The multiple gods and such. In verse 11, and after 3 months, we set sail on a ship of Alexandria, which had wintered in the island, whose sign was the twin brothers. Randy, you may have that identified in the New American Standard.
It says Greek, the Dioscuri, i.e. Castor and Pollux, twin sons of Zeus.
Yeah, that identifies the Greek gods, as it were. It says, in touching the Syracuse, we tarried there 3 days, and from thence we made circuit and arrived at Rhegium. And after 1 day, a south wind sprang up, and on the second day we came to Aetolia, where we found brethren and were entreated to tarry with them 7 days. And so we came to Rome. This portion of the text, I think, is quite fascinating to me because we learn that Paul, as he comes to toward his destination, the people from Rome come out to meet him, brethren. And we want to note that in this context. In verse 15, it says, "And from thence the brethren, when they heard us, came to meet us as far as the market of Appius and the three taverns, whom, when Paul saw, he thanked God and took courage." Now, brethren, I want us to see this point. The Apostle Paul has been through what we might describe as a horrific experience. But when these brethren came, that was comforting. When we begin to look at the epistles that Paul wrote, we see, for example, and we've discussed this, the epistle written to those in Corinth, we see all kinds of problems that are addressed. But you'll notice early on in the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul gave thanks to God for his brethren. You'll note that to be so in almost every epistle that the Apostle Paul wrote. We see that, I think, in the first chapter of Romans, Romans chapter 1. You just follow the course of the beginning of most all of the epistles that Paul wrote and see that he was thankful to God for his brethren. And I tell you what, when you go somewhere, and perhaps you've not had this experience, but maybe you have, and things are not so good for you, and you have the opportunity to be among brethren, that's comforting. When you go somewhere where you're not known and you know no one, and you get to stay in the house of some folks who are brethren, that's comforting. Because you share already, before you ever find out what their names are, you know that there are some characteristics that you share. So there's a very real sense in which you know these people. You know what their values are. You know what they believe. You know how they treat people. Why? Because they're Christians. They're folks of, as is said, of like precious faith. And so you have all of these things in common with them. Now when Paul is on his way to Rome and the brethren come out to meet him, it's a great occasion. He has reason to rejoice and be of good courage. He thanked God. Verse 16 says, "And when we entered into Rome, Paul was suffered to abide by himself with the soldier that guarded him." Again, Randy, I'm reading from the American Standard. The New American Standard, in place of the word suffered, probably uses a different word.
Are you talking about verse 16?
Yes, please. Allowed him to. All right. So Paul is allowed to abide by himself with the soldier that guarded him. Now, interestingly enough, in Rome, Paul is granted privileges. We know that as he's in Rome, some have said that he was somewhat under house arrest. We know that he was privileged to have his own hired dwelling, yet chained to a soldier. But that granted Paul all kinds of privileges while he was in Rome. I want to click on past some of these to get to where I want to be. Oh, yes. Rome. At this time, population of about 1 million people. You know, that blows my mind, I guess, to think of an ancient city that has so many people in it. We're told that there were about 1,790 palaces, government buildings, sports complex. Rome was quite the city. And this is the place that Paul was privileged to be, in his own hired dwelling. Now, we're going to talk in our next study about what privileges that brought to him. People that could go and come, the opportunity to teach and so forth in Rome. And as Chris pointed out earlier, when we talk about Paul's belief that he would see Rome because God had said that, God didn't tell him that you'll go there as a prisoner. That wasn't up front and readily known. All right, we'll stop with that and start some more Sunday morning.